Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, from New Orleans, the president declared the federal government will spend and spend big to rebuild the ravaged Gulf Coast.
The work that has begun in the Gulf Coast region will be one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen. When that job is done, all Americans will have something to be very proud of.
One of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen. There's talk of a Marshall Plan for the Gulf Coast. The president gave no price tag, but the estimates are $200 billion and counting, with all that means for the federal budget. Meanwhile, what will the new New Orleans, the new Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama coasts look like? Beyond repaired levees and repaved highways, what about the social structure laid bare by Katrina? Will the tide of money lift all boats? This hour on Point, filling in the blanks on President Bush's brave new Gulf Coast. We begin today with a look at the president and his speech. Joining us from Washington is Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So, what was at stake as the president stood there in Jackson Square last night, in your view, Karen?
Well, basically, nothing less than his own presidency. I mean, he went before the cameras last night at the lowest point of his presidency, both in the sort of broad gauges of popularity. Our latest poll has him down to 40% job approval, but also in, I think, people's assessment of the very reasons he got reelected last year, which was basically strength and competence.
And he's attempting to put all that forward, to move it forward with this vision for the Gulf. But is vision the right word? How are people responding, Karen? There's a promise here, but maybe not a structure for what will go into it.
Oh, I think it was a very ambitious speech. It did not have sort of the rhetorical flourishes that we have come to associate with his most important speeches. But the program itself and the amount of resources that he is talking about committing to this, the White House is estimating, as you said, $200 billion, maybe more.
Though he carefully avoided putting any number out there last night.
Right. But it's extraordinary. And quite frankly, the, you know, greatest challenge for him right now, this president who has built his presidency on the Republican base, is going to be selling this program to the Republican base. And by the way, one of the, I think, under-noted elements of that speech last night was the fact that he talked about a vast new commitment for the military. This is exactly what the Pentagon does not want to hear at a moment when they're already feeling overextended.
And by that you mean a greater readiness to have the U.S. military involved in domestic crises when they emerge, like Katrina.
Absolutely, and to put it in far more of a almost a first responder role, to make it, as the president, who was, I thought, quite frank about acknowledging how government had failed, and by extension, how he had failed, improving coordination and making the military very much a part of this.
Is that controversial in judicial terms, in legal terms in the U.S., Karen? Is that going to be challenged?
Well, it will definitely require, you know, depending on how far he wants to take this, it certainly could require revisiting the 19th century law known as posse comitatus, which prohibits the military from being engaged in law enforcement.
And
that's one of the reasons, by the way, that Governor Blanco was so insistent in Louisiana last week of maintaining control of those National Guard troops. Because if she had turned them over to the federal government, to the Pentagon, as the White House was pushing her to do, there would have been some real legal questions as to whether they could have been involved in law enforcement, which at that moment was one of the biggest needs out there.
And, of course, the South, with its own long memory of troops from elsewhere or under the control of others on its turf, what about the scale of this rebuilding? Can the president's promising higher, bigger, better, can he simply do that on his own hook? What does he need from Congress here, Karen?
A lot of money. And I thought that my colleague Matt Cooper has a piece on Time.com, our website today, where he points out the fact that Bush was standing near a statue of Andrew Jackson in Orleans, you know.
In Jackson Square, of course, right.
New Orleans. Mm-hmm. In fact, he said it probably should have been a statue of Lyndon Johnson, who was the last president to try a massive, you know, expansion of social spending while he was trying to fight a very expensive war that wasn't going well.
Karen, you've been watching this president for a long time. Try and take us behind his presidential face last night. What do you think George Bush is making of this? Because he knows very well that this is more in the footprints of LBJ than in those he would have predicted for himself, I should think.
And so what he is going to have to do is try to stress some of the elements of this proposal that the conservatives like. He's already lifted the so-called Davis-Bacon law, which requires government contractors to pay prevailing wages. He's talked a lot about, you know, loaning monies to small businesses and you know, giving people, you know, essentially, you know, very, very much sort of free market ideals. But the fact is that these are relatively small parts of a massive social spending program, and I think the conservatives are going to see that immediately, and there's already some noise on the right. I think it's going to get a lot louder.
Big talk and a big vision and a tussle ahead very likely within the GOP. Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We turn now to Jackie Combs, national correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She's been writing on exactly those tensions in Washington and within the GOP over the kind of scope of rebuilding that President Bush has described last night. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
Get specific with us. Who's coming down on what side of this argument in Washington about the money, the spending behind these big plans?
Well, I think it's important to say at the outset that nobody, even in the most conservative Republicans, is opposing the money that's been committed to date, which is now $62 billion, and they'll even concede it'll have to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
But they say they're not willing to vote for another penny unless there's offsetting spending cuts. And to date, they've been unwilling to put tax cuts on the table, since those are sort of dogma for the Republican Party right now. But even yesterday, Senator Tom Coburn told me, a conservative from Oklahoma,
right,
that he'll even think twice about voting to extend tax cuts until there's some fiscal restraint to accompany this new spending for the Gulf. And, you know, this, it has to be said, is not a majority of the Republicans, this position, but it's a good number. And you have to remember that everything the president has done in recent years has been passed with mostly Republican votes, since Democrats are typically arrayed against him. And so he needs all of his Republican rank and file in line. And if a goodly fraction of them are going to buck, then he's going to have trouble and will have trouble, I would predict, with a good number of his initiatives throughout the rest of the second term.
Though on recovery, this may be an area where the president could lean to the Democrats, who surely would not want to keep the purse closed for rebuilding the Gulf.
Right. And they're, you know, they all want to have a hand. It's just this is going to have ramifications for his entire agenda.
Speak to the issue of control over what's going on there, Jackie. You've written really interesting on this, on the battle shaping up about who's going to guide whatever happens here. What are the battle lines there?
Well, you know, Americans' eyes probably glaze over if I use the term federalism, but it's the really bedrock of our system of government. This no other country has one quite like it, where you have this, you know, diffuse powers among local, state, and federal officials,
mm-hmm.
and nothing has brought this to the fore, the tensions inherent in that, like Hurricane Katrina's wake. And so you have, you know, New Orleans is a proud city, and I don't want to give short shrift to the Mississippi Gulf Coast either, because it's been devastating. And
mm-hmm.
all these little towns, they've got pride in their local heritage and culture and infrastructure, but they need help, and so the state's going to come in, and the federal government has to be there. But everybody, you know, the local and state people really want to have the final say. And
on the shape of the redevelopment, on what
shape,
it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then you get these questions like, well, if you build roads a certain way, do you really want to encourage development in a particular area? I mean, the whole question, whether it's New Orleans or the Mississippi Gulf Coast, of whether you should even rebuild houses on on our coasts. You know, it's, and it goes not just there, but, you know, we're seeing it on the North Carolina coast all the way up the eastern seaboard today with Hurricane Ophelia, and then you see it in California repeatedly. And, you know, so those kind of questions about whether people can even have the freedom to live in certain places. But, you know, the federal government, as President Bush indicated last night, is going to have a big, big role, and with that will be a big say. But at the other hand, on the other hand, he's gone out of his way to say that the locals will have a lot to say. And to that end, you know, Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, Republican, who used to head the entire National Republican Party, is like his best source in the region. And so, you know, that's, I think, going to guarantee that the states have something to say about this. So on the other hand, you have tensions in Louisiana where most of the officials are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of, you see it in the finger pointing that's been going on. So it's going to continue through the rebuilding as to what should be done and how to do it.
And then, Jackie, as you point out, in New Orleans itself, there's this question of whether the lowest lying areas should be rebuilt. But those also happen to be areas where much of New Orleans' black population lives, African Americans. And if they're not rebuilt, it would change the demographics of that city in a way that might be offensive to that population.
Exactly. I mean, we're seeing a lot of stories now in which evacuees are saying, and many of them African American in the stories I've seen on TV and newspapers, saying they're not going to go back. I think we'll see a lot of that. The population, I would guess, would definitely shrink. On the other hand, you know, I've talked to people in Louisiana and New Orleans, and they say, well, people say that now, but we're going to rebuild it so well, they're going to eventually come back. Well, maybe, but there's definitely going to be a change, and the president said something really interesting last night, but he didn't expand on it, and it's not quite clear what he means when he talked about a new Homestead Act. Now, the Homestead Act is, you know, people might remember.
This is the lottery where people could get money to build homes, and we're going to look at just that. Jackie Combs, I know we've got to let you go. We appreciate your insights this hour. Thanks for being with us.
All right, great, thanks.
Jackie Combs, national correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. We are talking about rebuilding after Katrina. Filling in the blanks in the president's big speech last night, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rebuilding after Katrina, filling in the blanks on the president's big speech last night. Let's remember just how straightforward he was with the scope of his commitment.
And tonight, I also offer this pledge of the American people. Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know. There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
This great city will rise again. The president standing in Jackson Square in the French Quarter of New Orleans last night. You can join our conversation. Were you cheering the president on last night? Or were you breathless at the likely price tag, waiting for the fine print? Are we building too much, too big on vulnerable coasts, or is it the national obligation, the national character to rebuild bigger, better, stronger? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined now from Dallas, Texas, by Bob Becker. He's Chief Executive Officer of the New Orleans City Park, formerly Director of City Planning for New Orleans. Mr. Becker, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
And we are joined from Sacramento, California, by Ari Kelman, Professor of History at the University of California, Davis. He's author of A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans, formerly a resident of New Orleans. Ari Kelman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
I'd like to get from each of you just your first reactions to the president's very large-scale kind of broad-stroke picture last night. Bob Becker, first to you. You've been director of city planning at the heart of what got hit. Were you comforted by this? Does it seem like the right gist in the right direction? Your response.
Well, I think if you're here, or if you're in New Orleans and you have witnessed the scope of the devastation that has occurred, you have to be heartened by the president indicating that the country will do what it takes. You know, the entire Gulf Coast is a vital part of this nation in many, many ways, economically, culturally, et cetera. And to hear the president say that he will do what it takes to to repair the damage of this devastated region, you know, it has to give you some good feelings when you're on the ground.
And Ari Kelman, you've looked very broadly at the environment of New Orleans. The president's giving a big yes, we will commitment to rebuilding. But what questions did it leave you with foremost?
Well, I think the foremost questions have to be how exactly is this going to be paid for? And I think perhaps even more important than that right now, given that, that so many people believe that it's worth the investment in a city like New Orleans, it's worth the investment to rebuild the Gulf Coast, exactly how is this going to happen? Who's going to be in charge? What will the rebuilding look like? These are questions that, for the most part, right now are probably unanswerable. But the question last night, or the speech last night on the part of the president was, from my perspective at least, remarkably vague on those points.
What about this issue, just at the heart of this, again, with New Orleans? There's talk of essentially turning large areas into retaining ponds, the lowest-lying areas of New Orleans, saying, we just can't protect these, we're going to give them up. They happen to also be the areas which have been poor black neighborhoods. Ari Kelman, is all the city to be reclaimed? Should part of it be let go? And what does that mean politically and demographically and in terms of individuals' lives there?
Let me start by saying that I have not been in New Orleans since the storm struck, but as I understand it, we should be clear on the point that much of what most Americans think of as the heart of New Orleans, or at least the part of the city that tourists visit, is actually in relatively good shape. The French Quarter, the Uptown Garden District, the Faubourg Marigny, the area of New Orleans immediately downriver from the French Quarter.
And we saw that last night with the White House floodlights there on St. Louis Cathedral. You know, that little chunk at least looked pretty good.
That's right. All of these areas, these are the oldest parts of the city, and therefore they were built on the highest ground. They were built before the so-called back swamp, the cypress swamp at the city's rear, had been reclaimed at the beginning of the 20th century. So those parts of the city are in good shape. The areas that are in the greatest jeopardy and have always been in the greatest jeopardy, that are in harm's way most of the time, are those low-lying areas. As you say, there tends to be a correspondence between the lowest-lying areas of New Orleans and the deepest concentrations of poverty in the city. So when people are talking about allowing wetlands to encroach on terrain that was reclaimed from the back swamp at one point, I'm left with the question, where are the people who lived in those communities going to go? And areas like the Ninth Ward, those were communities. These people made it through from month to month, sometimes from week to week, based on the networks of association that they had. They knew who their ministers were. They knew who their neighbors were. Sometimes they knew their grocers. If they ran out of baby formula before the end of a month, if they ran out of food, they knew who they could go to in order to survive. Uprooting these people, as they have been right now, strikes me as being a kind of insult to injury. And talking about allowing wetlands to move back into that area, while the environmentalist in me says that might be a reasonable idea, it might make good sense, the humanist in me says I'm just not at all sure about that. I worry that that would be a social catastrophe on top of what already has been a horrible disaster.
Bob Becker, speak to this same issue of how much of New Orleans should come back. You've got this 2002 preliminary study from the Army Corps of Engineers saying fortify, raise the levees to maybe as high as 30 feet from the current 13 to 18 feet. But then I'm reading here Sherwood Gagliano, he's president of Coastal Environments, Inc., a big expert on coastal restoration, saying you don't want to put a lot of people back in those holes. Essentially, they're just not tenable. What about that issue just around New Orleans itself?
Well, in the city, I think Professor Coleman's right, you have to look at the city in segments. And a lot of the city survived very well with only wind damage. So those areas are going to come back. And my guess is in the next couple of weeks, you'll have 50,000 people reoccupy the city on the West Bank, in the Central Business District, in the French Quarter, in the uptown areas, little bits and pieces along the lakefront that did not suffer the flooding but suffered only wind damage, and that will be cleaned up pretty quickly.
So that's the easy part, but the president's looking at the big long-term picture here.
Well, the big long-term picture has to do with a lot of factors, Tom. We have to remember, too, that the massive flooding that occurred in the city did not come from the main hurricane protection levee system being overwhelmed. It came from breaks in canals that delivered water from the center part of the city into like Pontchartrain. Why those canals failed is a major question. But the main hurricane protection levee of the city did not fail and was not overtopped by a storm that exceeded the design capacity of what those levees were built for. So that has to be taken into consideration when we talk about rebuilding. There certainly is the capability of rebuilding a lot of the city that was flooded if we take care to prevent those things from occurring again.
Should it all be brought back?
The social cost of this is indeed a staggering question. I don't think something the country has faced maybe since the Great Depression of what to do with the fact that areas that were the lowest, that contained the highest proportion of black citizens, that were the greatest proportion of poverty, have been pretty devastated and are probably unlivable for some period of time. So there's a physical aspect of this to rebuild the city, and there's a tremendous social aspect of what's going on here. And everyone recognizes the cultural significance of the black community, and particularly the working class community in the Lower Ninth Ward and other areas that have been deeply affected by this. And I think everyone recognizes that that was a cohesive community in many ways, and every effort should be made to bring it back in some ways. On the other hand, Tom, you have to balance and look at, if you looked at the big picture and you were designing the perfect city, you would not design a city where 40% of the population was in abject poverty. You would not design a city where the school system was so horrendous that people could not expect that their children could rise out of poverty because they can't get a decent public education here. We have to correct those things. We have to address those issues in the rebuilding of the city, because a huge portion of our population was permanently disadvantaged in where they were, and we're never going to escape this cycle. And there's a huge opportunity to do that, to turn around the lives of lots of people that right now in the middle of one of the most incredible tragedies I have ever witnessed and been a part of, there is an opportunity to improve things for people and help them get better lives. Some of them will get them not in New Orleans, and many of them will get them in New Orleans.
I want to talk about how that might be done and whether you saw the bones of that emerging in the president's speech last night, but a lot of callers want to join us, and I want to begin to turn to them as well. John is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, folks. I'm going to qualify everything by saying I'm a conservative more than I'm a Republican. I had voted for George Bush, and I think this is absolute insanity.
What in particular?
Well, for one thing, just to throw out a number of $200 billion when we do not even know the extent of the contamination of the houses that are there. And I find myself in agreement with the professor from UC Davis, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Where there is a human tragedy there. I do not want to congratulate and more or less quantify what New Orleans has done to itself. What we are doing is say you can do whatever you want. There has to be, George Bush can say $200 billion. What I would like to hear as a conservative is that, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take that $200 billion from something else. I know there's a $275 billion highway bill that is just loaded with pork where we can get money.
But John, let me ask you, I want to be sure I understand. First, he didn't say the number last night, but it is being floated by the White House. Are you on board with the rebuilding? You just want to know where the money's going to come from?
Let me put it this way. If we can get it from somewhere else where there is a lot of waste in the government, I think this would be an ideal opportunity to really start to look at government spending and just to write a blank check simply because we can. You know, that hardly makes any sense to me. And if I could just say one more thing. I did lose my train of thought.
It's all right, John. You put a lot out there already, and there you represent that Republican, or as you say, conservative view that, wait a minute, what about the bottom line here and the national deficit? Let's get another view. Mark is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Mark?
Rebuild it. And I am also a conservative Republican and voted for George Bush. And yeah, it does sound like a big spending plan, but I don't care. It's the same thing he brought up in rebuilding Chicago after the fire. You rebuild. It's what America does. San Francisco, the great earthquakes. From those tragedies came about different code changes in buildings, and the same thing will happen in New Orleans. We have great resources as a country, and we will overcome those things. And if we can spend the kind of money we're spending to rebuild Iraq, we can certainly spend it in our backyard.
That is, we can do it all, Mark?
Absolutely. Why can't we? Same thing as the World Trade Center. I agree with Donald Trump. go back, rebuild the buildings, and build it one floor higher. We do things that way. It's not arrogance. It's confidence. It's the fact that we overcome. I'm not, take all the political jargon out of it. That's for other political people. I really don't care. Go in, rebuild the thing.
We hear it. Higher, bigger, better, stronger. Mark, thanks for your call. I want to turn to Jackson, Mississippi. We're joined from Jackson by Leland Speed. He is executive director of the Mississippi Development Authority. He's a real estate developer himself, chairman of the East Group Properties and Parkway Properties. Leland Speed, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity.
Mr. Speed, you're very plugged in. I understand you're close to Haley Barbour, who, of course, was chairman of the Republican Party, close to George Bush. I'm sure you were watching and listening very closely last night. Were you happy with what you heard from the president?
I was very happy with what I heard.
As a Mississippian, as a developer, how are you responding?
Well, you've got to look at the numbers we have here in Mississippi. We, according to FEMA, we have over 200,000 people that have registered as disaster victims with FEMA. And the Red Cross says that over a third of the homes in the six southern counties in Mississippi, that's a third of 171,000. So we're talking about over 50,000 homes have been destroyed in Mississippi.
So you need help, but there's the issue of how much it costs and who's going to be in control. There's talk of out there of Jack Welch, the former head of GE, being in charge of a big federal effort, of General Tommy Franks, of Colin Powell. What about this issue of control, Leland Speed?
Well, we aren't waiting in Mississippi for the feds. As a matter of fact, the governor has appointed, Governor Barbour has appointed a 30-person board to oversee this entire thing. And it's headed up by Jim Barksdale, the former CEO of Netscape.
Mm-hmm.
We're having our first meeting Tuesday afternoon in a tent in the parking lot of a shopping center in Gulfport.
And good on you for the initiative, but you will be waiting on those billions of federal dollars, and if a big commander out of Washington comes with them, how do you feel about that?
Well, we think we're going to give everybody a little help. We have actually been blessed with some generous offers of help by some very capable people. I'm not in a position to announce it right now.
Do you mean money help or leadership help?
Talent, skill, and leadership help.
Mm-hmm.
And money, as far as that goes. We have one offer of $40 million for our school system.
It's a lot of money, but it's nothing like the billions, hundreds of billions we're talking about out of Washington.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I feel that the real bulk of the money that's going to come for rebuilding is going to come from the private sector. And if we can't create an environment that's attractive to private investment, no amount of federal funds or state funds is going to get the job done.
We hear it, and we hear exactly where you sit in that picture. Leland Speed, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Leland Speed, Executive Director of the Mississippi Development Authority. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I tell you what has me very, very concerned. I read in the New York Times yesterday in Elizabeth Buemiller's column that Republicans said Karl Rove is in charge of the Reconstruction effort.
Well, I did read he's looking maybe for someone to head it up, a lot of people with their hand in the pie here, but what's your concern?
Well, my concern is, and by the way, I didn't read that he was looking for someone to head it up. I read that he was in charge. That's the quote from the New York Times and also the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that putting a political operative whose entire career has been devoted to electing Republicans and raising the funds to elect Republicans is a very poor start to this Reconstruction effort. How are we supposed to have any confidence that he will do anything with those funds except use them to reward Republican contributors and then to obtain contributions in return from them?
Mark, let us pick that up. Our time is short before the break, but it goes right to the political point here. Bob Becker, it is a Republican White House. They are going to be proposing. How do you feel about Karl Rove and the whole political face of what's likely to transpire here?
Well, Karl Rove doesn't inspire me with much confidence in terms of being able to head such an effort. You obviously need someone with tremendous leadership capabilities, but someone who has experience in this sort of thing. I mean, this is obviously a disaster of incredible proportions. So
Jack Welch, Tommy Franks, Colin Powell.
What they can do. You know, I think people who have experience with massive undertaking, massive infrastructure issues, those are the kind of people that have to be considered.
Eric Kalman, just a couple of seconds before the break, but are you worried about politics running away with this? There's going to be a lot of money spent. It won't necessarily be spent right.
I'm extraordinarily concerned about that. I'm particularly concerned because I think what we're seeing right now are the fault lines that exist within the Republican Party, and the question is going to be which side of the Republican Party, which is in power right now, is going to control this operation ultimately.
We will
is
come
it going
back
to be this?
We'll come back and look at just that, Ari Kelman. Bob Becker, please stand by. We're talking about rebuilding after Katrina. You can join us. What is your vision for a rebuilt Gulf Coast, a revived New Orleans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rebuilding after Katrina, filling in the blanks in the president's big speech last night. We're joined from Sacramento, California by Ari Kelman, author of A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans, former resident of New Orleans, and from Dallas, Texas by Bob Becker. He is former director of city planning for New Orleans. You can join us as well. What is your vision for how to pay for all this? More taxes? Cuts elsewhere? Did you hear the right note in the president's speech last night? And what about the social rebuilding beyond the bricks and mortar? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's listen to just a bit of the president's remarks last night where he was talking about poverty and issues of race embedded here.
Within the Gulf region are some of the most beautiful and historic places in America. As all of us saw on television, there's also some deep, persistent poverty in this region as well. That poverty has roots in a history of racial discrimination, which cut off generations from the opportunity of America. We have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action. So let us restore all that we have cherished from yesterday, and let us rise above the legacy of inequality.
Poverty, race, and a whole lot of rebuilding and a whole lot of money, a lot on the table. Barbara's calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air. Hello, Barbara. Are you there, my friend? Sounds like we may have lost Barbara. Let's go to Barbara in Nashua, New Hampshire. Another Barbara here. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air. Hello. We'll get back to those calls in just a moment. Bob Becker, let me ask you on this front. You began to speak to it earlier, but the president saying we saw sort of laid naked and make the whole country very uncomfortable and the world kind of slack-jawed the poverty and the face of it in New Orleans, at least. How would the country go about rebuilding here in a way that doesn't replicate that? You say we can't. How do we avoid it?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, that is something for us to really grapple with. I certainly don't have all the answers. If anybody tells you they have all the answers on that, they're lying to you.
Mm.
You know, it the storm did make it very clear, I think, to all Americans that, you know, there is a persistent and a big problem in poverty, certainly in New Orleans, but in many great major American cities and in other places throughout the country. And the fact that, you know, we have moved our economy in a way and our programs in a way that seem to increase the distance between the haves and the have-nots and the people who have access to virtually nothing. Perhaps the storm does something good here in terms of pointing out that this is not the way to build a society in the 21st century. How do we do that? How do we correct this? Well, some people, I think, are going to have it corrected simply because of the devastation that's occurred. They're going to be relocated to other parts of the country. They're going to get massive assistance. They're going to find that there's a better school system than they were having here in New Orleans.
Are they going to get massive assistance? I mean,
I think so. I really do believe that. It's not, you know, not that everybody has it, because obviously the extent of the storm is so huge, but a lot of people, I think, will get the assistance that they want. A lot of people will choose to move other places where they see a better opportunity for them and their family. other people will see the opportunity to rebuild the city, to reestablish community ties, and they will move back, and they will need help as well. So the opportunity to address this is there. Exactly how it does, I'm not sure I know, and I'm not sure anybody knows now, but the opportunity is there if we're ready to seize it.
Ari Kelman, how do you see it? There's been a lot of talk about how New Orleans was a dysfunctional city before Katrina. Now this president is saying we're going to rebuild it. How do you imagine the political instincts and this kind of bifurcated party, increasingly it seems, in the Republican side, will intersect with this opportunity ultimately?
Let me first just echo what Bob said. I don't think that there are anyone right now who can tell us exactly how to solve these problems. What I would say, though, is that my principal concern is that we're going to suffer once again in this country from a kind of disaster amnesia that will see us forgetting the poor. For the moment, all of our attention is focused on the issue of poverty and the issue of racial equity, the issue of environmental justice.
Well, our language is focused on it anyway.
Well, I think actually our attention in this moment is focused on these issues. The question is, can we sustain that attention? Can we actually have an attention span that's long enough to begin to solve the problems? These issues very, very much are ones that can only be addressed with a kind of sustained political will. Right now, I think what we're seeing is a president whose numbers have dropped precipitously since the storm. And I think that he, rhetorically at least, is grappling with these questions. Now, what we have to wonder is, will his party, which is a very divided party right now, a party that's in power, is it going to make a long-term commitment to questions of poverty, environmental justice, and racial equity? The Republican Party's track record on each of these questions is not particularly good. We're already hearing people like Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma and others suggesting that New Orleans and the Gulf Coast might not be worth the money. And I think it's an open question. I, from my perspective, it's clearly an investment that we have to make. These people have suffered enough. They need to be able to go back to their homes if that's what they want to do. But the Republican Party is obviously badly divided. They have at least two different wings. They claim to be a party of compassionate conservatism. I think what they're realizing right now is that it's very, very hard to reconcile those two things, compassion and conservatism. We had one caller earlier who suggested, well, we've got to just rebuild the city. We've got the resources. Let's just do it. But you had another caller immediately before that who said the price tag is just going to be too high. Well, there we have it. Are we going to be willing to pay the price in this instance? Will we give people the assistance that they need? Are we going to have the kind of massive public works program that hasn't been seen in this country since the heyday of the New Deal coalition? These things are very, very hard for the Republican Party to actually reconcile. How do they support these things while at the same time working with their base that believes that we need to cut taxes as deeply as we possibly can? I'm not sure that it's possible to reconcile those.
And if it's done primarily through private enterprise, as Leland Speed was suggesting, what would that look like? I want to get another caller here, if I may. Allison's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
I have two comments. First, I think that we need to pay attention to the scientists that have been tracking our hurricanes for the last 50 years and feel that global warming is only going to do one thing.
And we have heard from that camp on this show, yes. And what else, Allison?
And my other comment is to put Karl Rove in charge of anything is on the brink of absurdity.
Well, the president's got a political problem right now. I guess he's responding in no small part in a political way.
I would agree. And that hasn't served us well in Iraq with providing no-bid contracts to his buddies. And I don't believe it's going to serve the American people well to put Karl Rove in front of an effort to rebuild anything.
Allison, let me ask you, if I may, you've been listening along. What about the issue of New Orleans and how much of it should be rebuilt? All of it? Some of it? What's your thinking?
I think that those areas on high ground, and, you know, I don't know enough about the city. Unfortunately, I've never been there. It goes out to anyone who's lost a home. I can't imagine.
Rebuild it all or not? Sounds like we've lost Allison.
Hey, hey Tom.
Yes, please.
Tom, it's Bob. Let me yes. just say something too that I think the country has to be aware of. You know, nearly 50% of the population of this entire country lives within 50 miles of a coastal area.
Yeah.
And the issues of rebuilding after tremendous natural events like earthquakes and hurricanes, you know, the country has spoken and the federal government has agreed, apparently, that it's all right to do that, that we can all live on the coast, or the majority of our citizens can live on the coast. Well, if we've decided that as a country, which I think we apparently have, then as a country, we have to be prepared to provide the resources to those communities to protect themselves to the maximum degree possible. And this is a huge price tag. I'm guessing that if you went to any of the American cities on the coast, you went to San Francisco, Miami, Charleston, any of those places and said, do you have a natural disaster plan, and is it fully implemented? Has it fully been fully funded? The answer would probably be no. And the country has to answer those questions. If we want people to live on the coast, if we've agreed that that's the right thing to do, and the vast majority of our citizens apparently have agreed that that's the right thing to do, then we have to be prepared to pay the cost to protect those citizens to the maximum extent that we can.
Well,
and I think this is a topic that's going to get a lot of national discussion.
Absolutely, and we're in the midst of some on-the-job training, some lifelong learning right now. I want to turn to one more voice here, if I may. Pierce Lewis is joining us from State College, Pennsylvania. He's Emeritus Professor of Geography at Penn State and author of New Orleans, The Making of an Urban Landscape. Mr. Lewis, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
To this point about whether or whether all of New Orleans should be saved, should be revived, or some of it should be turned over to wetlands. It sounds heartless, but what do you think?
Well, the parts of New Orleans that is most substantially below sea level and which is most, I think, susceptible to flooding, it seems to me as a candidate for being turned into some sort of public space and banning further building. I think that something that nobody has really talked about so far is that a lot of those houses are going to be unreclaimable, and a lot of those neighborhoods were essentially dysfunctional. I think the idea that it was all kind of one big happy family back there in the ghetto, I think, is simply not true.
So how do you envision it on the other side of an ideal recovery as, I don't know, as wetlands, as inhabited or not?
Well, if I were the king, which I'm not, obviously, I would be inclined to make a large area that is below sea level sort of off limits to building of any kind.
And what about the people who have built lives there?
Well, I was about to get to that.
Yes, sir.
The one thing that has not been mentioned anywhere on the program, as far as I've heard, is that there needs to be a massive program of public housing. I'm not talking about the kind of public housing that produced Cabrini Green in Chicago or a lot of the South Bronx. What I would think about is the kind of model that was used in Charleston by Joe Riley,
the mayor there.
Mayor. And what he did was to encourage the building and rebuilding of houses that were in the style of Charleston, and it worked out very well socially.
If anybody on our panel this morning understands exactly what the president meant by the Urban Homesteading Act and a lottery that would give federal land to some low-income citizens, are any of the three of you clued into the details of that?
Not I.
I don't think there are any details of it. I think the president has put out some sort of concept under a broad assumption that the federal government has lots of land in all of these communities, and that is the land that would first be made available for this sort of program.
Is that accurate, just to begin with? Is there a lot of federal land in or around New Orleans, for example, or along the Gulf that poor people would want to homestead in?
You know, there's not a lot of federal land in New Orleans that's not already occupied by federal facilities. I mean, I'm sure there are houses that have been reclaimed and repossessed for mortgage defaults or some sort, and I guess those certainly would be made available. There's probably other greater amounts of federal land along the Gulf Coast and Stennis Air Base and Stennis Base and other places. Now, whether or not you have any jobs to support a community that would be built there is a whole other matter.
If that's the housing recovery plan, one wonders. I want to try and get a couple more calls here. Camille's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Camille, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was actually calling about Post Hugo. Something that Mayor Riley did not do after the hurricane.
In Charleston there, yeah.
In Charleston, and it's part of the reason we have some of the most expensive rental properties in the country right now.
Mm-hmm.
He did not implement a rent freeze. which meant the laws of supply and demand came into play.
And up they went.
And tripled.
Tripled. That's high.
Tripled.
So what's the message in that?
The message in that is that there are laws of supply and demand, which the Republican Party loves. Fine. But disasters, you can't anticipate some of what's going to happen.
But it also means that a part of the population would be effectively driven out by the market if that takes place in New Orleans.
I don't live downtown anymore, and that is why.
We've got it, Camille. Thanks for the heads up there. Let me get another call here from Toronto, Canada. Gene is calling. Hi, Gene. You're on the
air. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I was born and raised in New Orleans. I was born at Tour Infirmary and lived in Uptown. And my fear is that they're going to build a theme park, a Disney-like theme park in New Orleans. And New Orleans is rich because of its shotgun houses and you know, the people talk about the Ninth Ward. Ninth Ward was very poor, but Ninth Ward had some similarities to Harlem, where you've got some professionals living there, and a lot of the richness was derived from the Ninth Ward. A lot of big problems, but I'm afraid that they're going to turn this into a sterile theme park.
But if you can't rebuild it as it was exactly, or wouldn't want to exactly, what do you do with the poor areas that are so flooded, so deeply destroyed?
Well, I think that you can create some decent housing, but it's got to be consistent with the architecture and what's historically been acceptable in New Orleans. And I noticed, look, I've lived there my whole life. Not my whole life. I was raised there as a young man. But New Orleans is, there's no question New Orleans is a dysfunctional city. I mean, you look at the police, you look at the levee board, you go on and on and on. But it's the gem. It's really one of our gems. Of this country, and it's something that we should be proud of, and we should build these. Sure, there've got to be some public housing, some decent public housing. Some of the worst public housing in the country is in New Orleans. They were going to tear it down anyway, but I think that there can be a good effort made in planning and putting something that's not only affordable but acceptable and consistent with New Orleans.
Bring it back, please, says the transplanted New Orleanian. Bob Becker, what about this issue? You hear people saying maybe New Orleans will end up as a kind of theme park with a lot of its population elsewhere, which would be the face of the city, but not its guts.
Well, I mean, you know, there are two aspects. There's the physical aspect of the city, and I think everybody agrees that the kind of architecture and that has to be consistent with what the city is famous for. And then there's the social aspect of the city. I know just from dealing with my own employees at City Park, the main recreation facility for the region, you know, those people displaced, they're all over the Gulf South. They want to come back. You know, they want to come back and build their lives in the city. They want the park to be great again. They want their communities to be great again. And, you know, you just have to believe that given the opportunity, people who think that their lives can be made better in New Orleans will come back to New Orleans. And we in New Orleans, we believe this. We believe this very, very strongly. If we give them the opportunity and they have an opportunity to get a job and they have an opportunity to earn a living, they will return.
Pierce Lewis, we've just got half a minute. If you look forward 10, 20 years, what do you imagine along the Gulf? Mr. Lewis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Oh, I'd prefer to evade that question for just a moment. I think there's something that's a lot more important, and that is that the chasm between blacks and whites, between rich and poor, has been exacerbated over the years by the perfectly wretched educational system, in the public educational system in New Orleans, which is, for most poor blacks, the only educational system they have available to them. Nearly all affluent whites send their kids to private schools very often.
And with that, we're out of time, but you remind us just how complex the picture is, how many pieces will need to be addressed, and the nation will have a front row seat for a long time. Pierce Lewis at Penn State University, author of New Orleans, The Making of an Urban Landscape. Thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ari Kelman, author of A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans, joining us from California. Thanks very much for being with us today, Mr. Kelman.
Thank you.
And Bob Becker, former Director of City Planning in New Orleans. Thank you for joining us, Bob.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.